Consumer spending rises in February.
But not as much as you might think, given those much-hyped tax cuts.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for listening to the podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, March 28th.
Coming up, the president faces criticism about the cost of the U.S. mission in Libya. Also, would you cross state lines for cheaper gasoline? Some people are doing it in the nation's heartland. And it seems AT&T's planned takeover of T-Mobile hasn't put a stop to the T-Mobile commercials making fun of AT&T.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
We start with today's news on consumer spending in February. It's up 0.7%. That's the fastest rise in 4 months. Let's bring in our regular Monday analyst, Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how is consumer spending rising so fast given the high cost of gas?
Well, actually, that's one of the reasons the spending numbers are so strong. Consumers have to spend more to fill their tank and to fill their grocery basket, and that shows up as stronger spending. If we strip out the effect of higher prices, spending only rose a more moderate 0.3%, and on average, so far this year, it's rising at about half the pace it was at the end of last year. So we are seeing consumers slow down a little bit on balance.
And Julia, this is the first consumer spending number that really takes into account those new payroll tax cuts that Congress passed late last year. Shouldn't this number be better given those tax cuts?
Well, that would be one view of the world. Another view is that consumers are actually very cautious and careful. And what they're doing, apparently, with their tax cut is they're saving a lot of that. Mm. So you give them a temporary tax cut, and they might just decide to pay down a credit card with it instead of rush out and spend some more. And that's what we're seeing. The saving rate has actually risen so far this year rather than fallen.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always.
Anytime.
Well, in some parts of the country, consumers hoping to avoid high gas prices simply cross state lines. Consider the border of Illinois and Missouri. Illinois has some of the most expensive gas in the country. Missouri has some of the cheapest. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Adam Allington reports, Missouri has a reputation for undercutting its neighbors.
One of the cardinal rules about interstate travel through the Midwest, gas up before you hit Illinois. Illinois levies a hefty 42 cents per gallon tax on gasoline, among the highest gas taxes in the country. Compare that with Missouri, which only charges 17 cents per gallon, and you're bound to see a lot of Illinois license plates in St. Louis gas stations.
We almost never buy gas in Illinois.
Cameron Holloway lives in Illinois and drives across the Mississippi River every day to work in St. Louis. During the last oil crisis in 2008, he actually ran out of gas trying to make it to Missouri.
I always know that in Illinois it's 20 cents or so more than it is in Missouri, and so I'm always going to fill up over here.
And it's not just gasoline where Missouri undercuts its neighbor. The state also has lower taxes on beer, liquor, cigarettes, even sales tax.
This is a fall on the sword issue when it comes to state fuel taxes, state tobacco taxes.
Ron Leone heads a lobbying group for Missouri's gas stations and convenience stores. He says the lower taxes attract tens of thousands of cross-border shoppers every day.
We will do everything within our power to keep them low, to keep them reasonable.
But critics point out that cutting taxes on gas or cigarettes has never actually increased state revenues or paid for any new roads or bridges. Ralph Martiri is the director of an Illinois think tank called the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability.
All the data show that supply-side theory of public finance, it just doesn't work. So anyone who's counting on that coming through, people buying substantially more gasoline because the taxes are lower, are, I think the technical fiscal term is goofy.
Martiri says a race to the bottom in taxes may not be a successful long-term strategy. He points to studies in Illinois that show every tax dollar spent on infrastructure has actually created $1.50 in economic activity. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Well, now to an item that's weighing down state budgets, the cost of unemployment benefits. As Marketplace's Janet Babin reports, this week the governor of Michigan is considering cutting those benefits.
Michigan recently passed a law that would slice jobless benefits from 26 weeks down to 20 weeks. Republican lawmakers say the bill would save businesses hundreds of millions in unemployment taxes. But the governor still has to sign the law, and Democratic Congressman Sandy Levin is hoping he doesn't.
This is such a serious backward step that we shouldn't give up.
The new law would make Michigan the only state to offer less than 26 weeks of unemployment benefits. But other states hit hard by the last recession. Arkansas, Arizona, Florida, and Indiana are also looking for ways to limit jobless claims and might adopt cuts of their own. Andrew Stettner with the National Employment Law Project says many states were unprepared for such high jobless claims.
There was kind of a belief that we wouldn't have severe recessions again. So states really stopped saving in terms of their unemployment insurance premiums.
Stettner says slashing benefits now could stall the fragile recovery. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 28th of March. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
President Obama will speak tonight about the situation in Libya, and he's expected to answer congressional critics who want more consultation and more communication about how much the no-fly zone is costing U.S. taxpayers.
We'll continue our coverage of the economic effects of the unrest in the Arab world now with our Washington bureau chief, John Dimsdale. Good morning, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
So is the money likely to be a big focus of tonight's speech by the president?
Yeah, absolutely. The president's going to have to answer critics who wonder what has the U.S. gotten itself into. Members of Congress who are back in session today say that, hey, we've been making real tough choices to trim spending, but you, Mr. President, without getting our approval, have made what seems like an open-ended commitment to spend more money on yet a third military front. Hmm. Here's Republican Senator Richard Lugar on Meet the Press yesterday.
But who knows how long this goes on? And furthermore, who has really budgeted for Libya at all?
And John, how might the president answer those kinds of questions?
Well, he'll say that military action is going quickly, successfully, relatively cheaply. But then there's the question of what sort of goal he has in mind in a post-Qaddafi Libya. Budget analyst Gordon Adams at American University says there's going to have to be some sort of financial help for the new government.
I would expect then some more normal kind of assistance package to come forward, but I don't see it as a stabilization, reconstruction, long-term occupation kind of exercise. That would be a lot more expensive.
And the president will have to answer what will be the cost to the U.S. if other nations in the Middle East, Yemen, Jordan, Syria, also require Western help to protect civilian protesters from their governments.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.
Well, we're going to get a little more analysis on this, and we're going to bring in Lawrence Korb. He served as Assistant Defense Secretary under Ronald Reagan, and he's a senior fellow at the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. Good morning.
Good morning.
Does the budget have the flexibility for an operation like this?
It has more than flexibility. If you go back and you take a look at the bombing of Kosovo, the bombing of Bosnia, or even the no-fly zone in Iraq for 10 years, we never spent more than about $2.5 billion. And in a Pentagon baseline budget that's over $550 billion, you have more than enough flexibility.
How is the president going to explain the cost of this to the nation, especially when there's such a contentious budget debate going on?
Well, I think he has to point out that in terms of previous operations, for example, in Kosovo, we did 75% of the bombing. Here, we're going to probably be below 50%. Even that is not a complete extra cost because planes fly every month just to keep the pilots in proficiency. We conduct exercises. The ships were already in the Mediterranean. So I think he can point out that this is not going to be overly expensive, certainly compared to Iraq and Afghanistan, and others are going to shoulder much of the burden.
Lawrence Korb is former Assistant Secretary of Defense and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Mr. Korb, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, while the air assault continues in Libya, there's another army attacking Muammar Gaddafi's foreign assets. How does asset tracking work? Marketplace's Stephen Beard filed this report.
here is an asset tracker at work.
I put it somewhere here. Oh, yes, there we are. OK, so this is what you call an organogram, which is...
John Christensen is a forensic accountant. Displayed on his computer screen are the results of his asset tracking, an organogram.
An organogram is basically like a family tree, which shows how the different divisions of a company are structured.
This took several years to complete. It shows how a Russian politician siphoned money from an oil company and then disguised its source by passing it through dozens of tax havens, a process called laddering.
First step on the ladder might well be somewhere like Cyprus, where you have a high degree of secrecy, a low degree of regulation. Each step of the ladder takes you closer towards your final destination.
Like London, once here, the laundered cash can be safely invested in stocks, bonds or real estate. But tracking the cash through the tax havens, through a dizzying number of anonymous trusts, can take decades.
Just this month, Swiss banks froze accounts linked to Baby Doc, who fled Haiti 25 years ago. It takes a long, long time.
William Britton Catlin of Financial Investigators, James Mintz. He says asset tracking is so tricky because despots and oligarchs can afford the finest financial engineers to hide their money.
There are lawyers, there are advisors, trustees, fiduciary agents, corporate structurers, tax experts.
And a lot of them here in London.
London is it's probably the centre of excellence for structuring money.
In other words, money laundering. John Christensen despairs of the Brits ever putting a stop to this flourishing industry.
We love the money. The money comes in by the billions, and we tend to ignore its source.
The UK says it has frozen all Gaddafi's British assets, reportedly worth $1 billion. But, says asset tracker Christensen, that's surely just the tip of an iceberg of undiscovered loot. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Starting today, Russia is staying on daylight saving time all the time, Jeremy. You ever thought, why do we change these clocks these days?
I wish we did exactly that. I would be happy to have us have it be light out till 7 or 8 p.m.
Summertime. It's very nice. No more changing clocks for Russia. When implementing the new plan, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said the time change had negative effects on people, even animals, right? He cited cows. Cows who were thrown off by the changed schedule of their milking routine.
Interesting.
Yes. So whenever we think about changing time, please think of the unhappy cows.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, March 28th. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter, at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm on Twitter as well, Radio Chio.
You can also give us your feedback by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says Contact.
A new survey shows a growing concern in the developed world about the increasing economic power of China. The research shows people in the U.S. are especially uneasy. The BBC's Rebecca Singer is with us now to talk about it. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning, Steve.
Why are Americans so concerned about growth in China?
Well, the survey doesn't ask them specifically why, but one of the big reasons being pointed to is the effects of the financial crisis. Now, the US is still climbing out of a big recession, while China appears to be bounding ahead. New York Times columnist and author Thomas Friedman says that's why the US is particularly concerned about China.
I would argue it's coming at a time when America has never been more paralyzed, more stagnating in the areas of infrastructure, education, precisely the areas we see China vaulting ahead on.
Now, the survey was conducted for the BBC World Service in 27 countries by the international polling firm GlobeScan, together with the University of Maryland.
How does the rest of the world feel, Rebecca?
Well, it's actually a similar concern in other rich countries like France and Germany and Canada. But in developing nations, especially in Africa, for instance, the feeling towards China is much more positive. Now, if you remember, China's invested heavily in countries like Nigeria and Kenya, and that investment has brought jobs and better infrastructure. And in fact, over the next 10 years, people say they expect China to be more important to their national economy than America is at the moment.
All right. The BBC's Rebecca Singer in London. Rebecca, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, the trend these days for TV viewing is video on demand and in your hand. Cable companies like Time Warner have developed iPad applications that allow subscribers to watch content anywhere. But how do the networks feel about all that portability? From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Time Warner makes billions selling subscriptions to its cable service. But Ben Z. Rose, president of the investment firm Battle Road, sees some signs the company's toying with a new way of doing business.
Yes, and I think that they're, you know, waking up to the fact that the old model may not be the one that prevails, you know, 3, 5, 10 years from now.
Rose says Time Warner execs would love to offer your favorite shows on any device at any time. So the company's new iPad app was a baby step in that direction. But the heads of major TV networks freaked out.
I think that they're paranoid about the loss of subscribers.
TV network execs worry Time Warner's app might change viewing habits, pushing Americans away from conventional cable. Networks get paid based on the number of cable subscribers they attract. So if you pull the plug on cable, networks lose.
And there's more and more of that going on.
New subscriptions are flat, so if Time Warner is going to start streaming their shows digitally, TV execs are going to insist the company pay handsomely for new digital rights. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, it seems the pending takeover of T-Mobile by rival AT&T hasn't yet stopped T-Mobile from running ads making fun of AT&T.
Oh, no. You knew this was going to happen,
Well,
too.
The ads are still running ads just like this one.
Look, sometimes you just got to pay more to be slower. Makes sense if you don't think about it.
And I think somebody in T-Mobile ad sales just got put on AT&T's list of redundant jobs.
Oh my goodness.
That can be eliminated when the merger goes through.
Oh, wow.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.